Hello, greetings and salutations. Welcome to episode 5 of Quantum Conversations, aka QC, where we touch upon a variety of topics and endeavor to do so with some saliency. But before we get into things, just a quick round of intros. My name is Nyusha, the show's host, creator, and occasional instigator. Joining me is Paul, who, when not busy with his day job, is the man behind our lovely theme music and often brings succinct observations or quips, but with his ever chill and calm demeanor. How's that for an intro, Paul? Hello.
Hello, Nyusha. Great to be here. Thanks for that very kind introduction.
My pleasure. So, Paul, you and I have spoken a bit about the name of this podcast and even joked about QC being mistaken for any number of things. Hello, quality control. And the thought has, obviously, it's crossed my mind that listeners who stumble upon us for the first time might wonder, where's all the science and tech stuff, right? Fair enough, people. I mean, when one thinks of quantum conversation, there's this general assumption that this is related to possibly quantum computing algorithms, input, output of metadata and megadata. And honestly, I feel like most of that stuff just goes over my head.
Yes, in my case, that would be quantum confusion.
I think it's about right.
There's a new nickname for our show.
You want to confuse, just join us here for a conversation.
There you go.
It is. I mean, I've read, I don't know. I mean, like, I've read articles and watched like intro videos, you know, sort of like introduction about quantum computing for dummies. And I sort of watch these or read these things and I get sort of a vague gist, but afterwards I'm like, no.
There's only so many hours in the day, right?
There's only so many hours in the day, indeed. So, I mean, well, our quantum conversation definitely leans more towards sort of the humanities and the, and we for sure explore the relevancy and impact technology has on our society, for better or for worse. And when we refer to the sciences, we look to it as much as at it. Because I think what we're really all about is encouraging conversations, which ask how much, as the Latin word quantum, well, that's the meaning of the word quantum, is how much. So I think it's worth inquiring, how much do we know? How much do we not know? How much of what we know is actually true? How much more do we need to consider? And how much wisdom and understanding has been lost, forgotten, or is being suppressed, controlled, and so on? It's, I think, a really good way to engage in a more meaningful way of understanding things and each other. And in doing so, we're doing it with an open, independent, critical, and discerning mind. Is that a lot to ask? I don't know.
Not at all.
Okay. So today, we'll be looking at one of the most important topics in our lives, sleep. Interestingly, it's amongst the most researched topics since a lack of good sleep seems to have become endemic. In fact, if you browse online, more recent articles use words like catastrophic, debilitating, epidemic, and detrimental when referring to our sleep-related issues. We'll take a glimpse at some of the potential causes relating to this, and we'll dig a bit deeper into the past to unearth some of the fascinating and nearly forgotten habits of sleep. So when I, or anyone for that matter, consider what the underlying causes of poor sleep might be, it is worth preempting that A, it's usually not just one or two things, and B, not everyone is affected by the same things. That said, there is enough data out there to suggest that large swaths of the population across demographics are negatively impacted, and to varying degrees, of course, by things like too much screen time, EMF disruptors, poor diet and health, lack of exercise, lack of contact with nature, with each other, poor work-life balance, etc. As this is in fact a vast topic, it's worth bearing in mind that we'll really just be attempting to give detailed glimpses of the many things impacting or relating to sleep rather than focusing on just one aspect of it. And if we go off on a few tangents during the course of the conversations, just bear with us. We'll eventually circle back. But before we begin, Paul, I'm sure you and I can affirm our own sleepless nights and struggles for 40 winks, yeah?
Yes, indeed. I've certainly struggled. I've, you know, had the insomnia where you can't fall asleep, where you can't wake up, where you do wake up too early for no reason, and you don't have to be anywhere. And then maybe the most frustrating one, waking up at the middle of the night and having no idea why. But I think we may touch on something later historically that maybe it's not as big of a problem as I thought.
Yes. What was the first thing we talked about?
Oh, yeah. I told you how stiff shoulders and neck and
I don't know what I did. I haven't been sleeping well, you know? Yeah. And I mean, I think this is just it. I do find that so many of my conversations with friends, there's always sleep that gets in there. Like, oh, how are you doing? Oh, I'm all right. I haven't been sleeping really well, or, you know, sleep has been an issue. I don't necessarily get up to or wake up too much in the middle of the night. But I think what I find is that it's very hard for me to get to sleep. And what I often see is that I have this sort of, let's just call it a pattern, where really sort of after I've eaten and maybe up until about 10 o'clock in the evening, I suddenly find a dip in energy and I'm like, oh, you know, and somehow after 10, though, it's like this energy kicks in and I'm like, yes, now's a good time for me to, you know, clean out my wardrobe, polish shoes, you know, like whatever.
Yes.
Whatever else.
The organization sort of, hours. Yes.
The organizational hours, as you do just before, you know, midnight. And then, of course, the problem there is that you have that energy and you're like, right, I have to get to bed. And so this starts creating a bit of anxiety because, you know, you only have X amount of hours to sleep and then you have to wake up in the morning. And these are the things that can be frustrating. And I think the same way is for those few occasions where I have found myself either not being able to fall asleep at all, or on rare occasion, maybe waking up and then not being able to go back to sleep. Then you go, all right, what can I do? Because if I fall asleep now, I'll have at least 4 hours.
Sure, sure. And
before I wake up.
I was going to say, usually I'm, then I, you know, an hour later I go, okay, if I fall asleep now, I'll have 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, that's a strange place to find yourself in.
And also, I just find it creates anxiety. So yes. You just get anxious about the fact that you need the sleep and you're not getting it.
Yes, it's a vicious cycle.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, these are some of the things that I think many of our listeners can relate to. And before we deep dive, well, we're doing a broad dive, but we'll see. We'll kind of do a deep broad dive, sort of, kind of, maybe. but before we do, Paul, where can our listeners find some of the stuff that we are going to be referring to?
Yes. So in the show's description, we will definitely leave some links for some of the things that we cite today and possibly a video or two, which I think we'll have on this episode. So please visit the description and all pertinent information should be there.
Great. Thanks for that. Okay. So I thought we could get the ball rolling with the more sciencey, that is in fact the science term among scientists, sciencey, related aspects of sleep. Specifically, I want to talk about EMFs. So EMF, for those that don't know, is short for electromagnetic fields. Sometimes I've seen it also being referred to electromagnetic frequencies, but this is not quite accurate. EMF is generally divided into sort of two different types of EMF. We have ionizing and non-ionizing EMFs. So ionizing EMF are things that generally emit high levels of radiation. So this could be UV from the sun, X-rays, gamma rays, etc. And they're also obviously higher, sometimes weaponized, ionizing radiation, and I think other things that you might find within the cosmos, right? And then there's non-ionizing EMFs, and these include ELF, and ELF stands for extremely low frequencies of EMFs or electromagnetic fields, radio frequencies, microwaves, visible light waves, and then there's sort of natural occurrences that we also have. So these are what we'll sort of be focusing a little bit more on, are the non-ionizing EMFs, and particularly the ELF. So just a little bit more detail, and I promise then we'll get into the nitty-gritty, as it were. So ELF has a standardization. And how did this come about? Well, I won't bore you with all of the history, but it is worth noting that this is something that goes under sort of an umbrella under the UN, which is the International Telecommunications Union. This was originally known as the International Telegraph Union, which was founded in 1865, and then later changed its name and was integrated into the UN after World War II, so in 1947. And this is kind of important to know because they are the ones that set the standard and framework around communication technologies. In addition, you then have the ICNIRP, which is the International Commission for Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection. And although they're sort of an independent body, they are then vetted by, say, the UN and the WHO. NASA are all sort of in agreement about sort of what ELF standardized frequencies would be. And these non-ionizing radiation frequencies are somewhere between 0 to 300 hertz, right? Okay. That doesn't sound like a big deal, because you're a musician, Paul. So I know that when you're playing guitar, you're also dealing with sound waves, and these sound waves can be a lot stronger than the 300 hertz that is mentioned here.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I just think it manifests itself differently.
Yeah.
Then say, you know, the lights or the energy.
Yeah.
The EMFs, you know.
The biggest difference is that we're dealing with something that's sort of man-made, artificial, versus mm-hmm. sonar waves or acoustic waves or other kinds of wave which sort of naturally occur, but obviously through an instrument they're sort of manipulated. But here mm-hmm. we have most of the EMFs that we're referring to when we're looking at our technologies and various devices that emit these ELFs. Well, these have what we, you know, what they're referred to as being as increased biological activity. So in other words, they disrupt cell membrane and our sort of electrochemical balance, because they have this thing known as polarization. And this impacts all cells, all nerves and muscles, and particularly obviously when we're looking at us, but also animals, and maybe, you know, I would say probably also extending to plants, even though plants don't necessarily have muscles in the way that we would think, but they certainly have cells. Mm-hmm. So this is why this is important to bear in mind, because this is quite different, right? So mm-hmm. now that we've gotten the sciencey bit out of the way, I wanted to sort of just take a look at, just briefly, without going into the studies too much, because we will attach the links for these studies. I wanted just to take a brief look at sort of comparatively two studies from the perspective of how things are framed.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Important. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So the first study comes that I want to sort of bring up comes from a consortium that's known as COSMOS. And this is a publication that you can find in the National Library of Medicine. And it's, you know, you can read the entire very dry sort of research. So the paper was published in 2020, I think in July of 2020. And I'm just going to give you guys the very engaging name, which is the paper is called Long-Term Effect of Mobile Phone Use on Sleep Quality, Results from the Cohort Study of Mobile Phone Use and Health, COSMOS. Like, that title alone might put you to sleep.
I could have used that last night.
Right? So this was an international, as I mentioned, this is an inter-European, I think it's probably a better way of putting it, study that began sort of around 2008, 2009, and was looking at the impact, obviously, of people's sleep and their mobile phone use habits, particularly before they went to bed. And long story short, they say, well, there's not a direct correlation between EMF particularly and, you know, EMF and people's phone use and their inability to sleep. They were looking at people's use of the phone, and yes, they were willing to concede that screen time and light factors can disrupt sleep, but they were also considering the fact that a lot of these people who were part of the study had maybe other factors such as insomnia and other sleep issues, so that, you know, the phone and phone use itself wasn't really an issue, right?
Okay.
And in particular, they were just sort of dismissive of, you know, the whole EMF or ELF output from phones. So there are a couple of things worth noting here in this study. So what they were using when they started out with this study, which was in 2008, and it included the UK, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Netherlands, and France, they used GSM, which is short for Global Systems for Mobile Communication, and UMTS, Universal Mobile Telecom Systems. And so these two systems then make reference to the bandwidth. So GSM has sort of, at that time, a 3G bandwidth, and UMTS had a 2G bandwidth. And then, of course, this paper gets published in July 2020.
Okay.
The problem being that from 2008 until 2020, the use of bandwidth increased. So we went to 4 and 5G already in many places.
Oh, yeah. Ridiculously increased.
Yeah, exactly. So even if there were like a 4-year follow-up, which this study included, it's sort of, there's this kind of a bit of a gap, right? So this is, I'm nitpicking at some of the components about the study that made me go, qua? And mind you, they did have a fair number of participants in the study. They initially invited like about 100,000 in the UK and over, you know, 250 throughout the other, you know, continental European countries. But of course, the actual number of participants is far fewer than those sort of cited as being invited, because that's also important to know, words matter, right? So Cosmos, this had sort of public private funding, as so many studies do nowadays. And the biggest issue here is transparency. So when I went and did a bit of digging and looked at the UK Cosmos branch, this was funded publicly at that time by the MTHR, which is a government entity, which was the Mobile Telecommunications and Health Research Program, later changed to the Research Initiative on Health and Mobile Telecommunications. But the big thing is, when I went online to try to find out a little bit more about this particular study, it lists that only £22,000 was given in as a grant for this study.
Wow.
Now, I'm having a hard time believing that a 10-11 year study would only receive £22,000 of public funding. Nice. First of all. The second thing is, we don't know which industries and how much funding was given by those industries for this study.
Yeah, that's a lot of important information missing.
Exactly. At least not from the UK cohort of Cosmos. However, from the European or the continental European cohort of Cosmos, when one goes all the way down and looks at, you know, like, you know, the disclosure information and, you know, are there any conflicts of interest, et cetera, that's where things get a bit more interesting, because that's where you begin to see the involvement of, let's say, sponsorship of mobile phone manufacturers such as Ericsson and Nokia, as well as several telecommunications companies.
Wow.
Which leads you to kind of see, well, of course, if telecom companies are involved and mobile phone manufacturers are involved, they would have a vested interest in the outcome of this publication to be, guess what? Mobile phones don't impact sleep.
Right.
There's no real conclusive evidence.
Mm-hmm. Sure. If they're sponsoring this study, you know, I think they're going to want it to not come out and say, use our product less, or, you know,
yeah.
they've got a vested interest, as you say.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole thing is, and I see this over and over again, you know, they have inconclusive sort of outcomes, or they're like, oh, further research is needed to clarify, like, which aspects of mobile phone usage are related to insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay. I mean, there's plenty of other studies that already, you know, indicate that yes, it does, you know. But the other things that, you know, this study kind of misses out on, even though they reference it briefly, is they don't talk about people's all-day exposure to screens, to Wi-Fi, to other EMF emitting equipment and devices.
Right. Oh, sure. It's widespread.
Yeah.
What we're exposed to every day, what it's scary to think what we don't know that we're exposed to, you know.
Yeah. So if the final conclusion is, you know, our findings don't support the hypothesis. This is what they say. Our findings do not support the hypothesis that RF EMF exposure from mobile phone use has long-term effects on sleep quality. Well, there's plenty of studies to dispute that. According to a Dr. Martin Pohl, who's a PhD professor at Washington State University, this is an area that he's an expert in. Continuous exposure to low-level radiation can have significant effects on our bodies before we even notice it.
Mm.
So if that's the case, then how can you say that that there wouldn't be that from mobile phones and that it wouldn't impact your sleep?
Sure.
Right? So just to compare that then to another study which predates this 2020 publication by about 8 years. So this is a study which was published in the Iranian Journal of Environmental Health and Science and Engineering. And then again, you can still find it on the NIH website, so you can read it for free. Here's the title of this bestseller. The effect of extremely low frequency electromagnetic field exposure on sleep quality in high voltage substations. So, in other words, this study was done at a high voltage electrical substation in the city of Kerman. And again, this was published in November of 2012. And the difference of the other study is that this publication begins with sort of an acknowledgement that EMF is known to cause significant health problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It says, you know, and what they're looking at specifically are the ELF, the extremely low frequencies of electromagnetic fields on sleep. And they were looking at high voltage substations, which in both the city of Kerman and its suburbs. And they used 177 people, 67 of which were workers between the ages of 24 to 57, and they are the people who worked at the substation. And then they had 110 people as part of a control group, and they were working, and these, again, were people of similar age, I think between the ages of 24 and 50, and they were working in different environments outside of that substation. Mm-hmm. Substation, and they were in hardworking, like, you know, we would say manual labor factories that were producing either copper or cement.
Okay.
Right. And so they were doing this study, and basically, lo and behold, the outcome of their study is that regardless of whether it was the control group or the workers, all of these people had really, really poor sleep quality as a result of these EMFs.
So either group.
Yes.
Wow.
It's worth noting for that the control group had even worse sleep. Part of it was due to the high workload that they have, the poor working conditions. So that also impacted their sleep even further. You know, they had fatigue, all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And what's more is they said, you know, it's worth noting that their measures of ELF were below the standards of the ICNIRP, which I previously had mentioned are the International Commission of Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, right? So we were talking about the ELF frequencies being at 0 to 300. So they were looking at people who were impacted by frequencies that were like, say, well below 300.
Right. Wow.
And we're living in some cases well outside of the substation, high voltage substation area.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of makes you go, all right, right? That's raised, that should be raising everybody's eyebrows, you know? And they said that you cannot reject the impact of these fields on sleep quality. That's what it states in their study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it says, you know, finally, exposure to electromagnetic fields or EMF has raised concerns on the possible health effects of them, meaning the workers, and therefore they have become an interest issue for a great numbered people, especially people who live near power lines. So because it has an impact on, you know, on your biophysical or your nervous and endocrine system.
Right.
And the biggest difference with this study is, and they have, you know, loads of detailed information about their, you know, control number versus their case numbers, the sleep time and the sleep scoring systems, etc. The biggest difference is that unlike the other study that there are no other vested interest groups other than the two universities and the scientists that were from these two universities. So namely the University of Kerman and the University of Tehran. So there are no telecommunication companies. There are no mobile phone manufacturers. There are no, you know, other private industries that you don't know anything about. In fact, you know, you would think that the high voltage substation would be up in arms about something like that. But in fact, they were like, yeah, go ahead and you know, test our people and see how they respond to to this in and how this impacts their sleep.
Interesting. Wow. It's amazing that you found that article. And also, you know, its independence, I think, is worth noting.
Yes, because there's no conflict of interest. And you can see that these people are doing a study. They're trying to figure out, do X, Y, and Z factors impact people's ability to sleep? And what other you know, components might there be in disrupting their sleep? And if we're looking at EMFs, or, you know, or including the ELF, the answer in this paper is yes, it does.
Right. Bold underlined, yes.
Yeah, exactly. In short, yes, it does.
Right. Well, thank you for those. That's very interesting.
Yeah, Paul. I know you've got some stuff for us as well, right?
Yes, indeed. So as I was taking a look at some things, like you said, just on a very shallow search, you find that, most doctors agree that on a lower level exposure, there is no harm from an EMF, right? So I, you know, kept going and I came across an interesting site called the emfscientist.org. And what this is in 2015, a group of electromagnetic scientists from around the world appealed to the UN, the World Health Organization, and the UN's environmental program to add more protections against EMF and its dangers. So according to emfscientists.org, as recently as 2023, over 250 electromagnetic scientists, I believe that number is 260 now, electromagnetic scientists from 44 nations around the world have signed an international EMF scientist appeal. They published over 2,000 peer-reviewed papers and letters on the health effects of non-ionizing electromagnetic fields. And that includes extremely low frequencies emitted by electrical devices and radio frequency radiation used for wireless communications. So according to the appeal, quote, numerous scientific publications have shown that EMF affects living organisms at levels well below most international and national guidelines. The effects include increased cancer risk, cellular stress, increase in harmful free radicals, genetic damages, structural and functional changes to the reproductive system, learning and memory deficits, neurological disorders, and negative impacts on the general well-being in humans. Damage also goes well beyond the human race, as there is growing evidence of harmful effects to both plant and animal life. Now, I'll say that obviously we're focusing on sleep here, and this is, you know, talking about the effects of health, but I think they go hand in hand, as you know, one affects the other, and sleep is extremely important to our overall health. So, and as EMFs, you know, have been shown, as we're talking about, to affect our sleep in general. So I think it's important to know these things. One of the spokesperson for this was a Dr. Martin Blank of Columbia University, and he would warns of these harmful effects in a video we'll attach below. I think he's quite an interesting guy. You know, Dr. Blank brought over 30 years of experience conducting EMF research at Columbia University and served as the president of the Bioelectromagnetic Society before his passing in 2018. He's quite a scholar. He's earned PhDs in physical chemistry in 1957 from Columbia, colloid science in 1960 from the University of Cambridge, and he came to the department in 1959 in Columbia and retired as an associate professor in 2011 as a special lecturer. So his research has been on. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so in other words, he's qualified.
he's qualified. He's qualified. And one thing I found, you know, interesting that I thought about, you know, here's a guy who probably as a child grew up sitting around the radio, listening to the radio, and then in, you know, the 1950s, you know, watching TV. Throughout the 60s, as the technology advanced, until the widespread use of cell phones, telecommunications, Bluetooth, 5G, as we were talking about earlier. So this is a guy who sort of lived this span, seeing it all change. And he was one of the major ones ringing the alarm bells here. So since then, I believe in 2021, the World Health Organization has since established the International EMF Project to assess health and environmental effects of exposure to static and time-varying electric and magnetic fields, and which, you know, it studies at low, intermediate, and higher radio frequencies. So that's all I could find as of now. So I think they've said, okay, we're looking into this, but we'll see what their conclusions may be.
Yeah, because I mean, the thing is with you know, they have another component, which is the IARC, which is the International Agency for Cancer Research, IACR. Anyway, I'm sure I've got my acronym wrong, which is still part of the WHO. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this goes, I mean, I'm really going back to like 20 years when there were these alarm bells already then, with like issues with phone masts going up. And, you know, there were numerous studies about and cases of people getting ill, what they call, you know, cancer cluster areas, or people having all kinds of symptoms from vertigo to, you know, migraines to really, really, again, disrupted sleep, because this kind of stuff disrupts your circadian rhythm. And, you know, people who were on advisories on the, you know, and they were part of these groups and part of the WHO, were there to say, yes, we recognize that these phone masts, for example, are carcinogenic, or they are possibly carcinogenic, because they fall under these classifications. They're like these four groups. I think that is it the IARC? One second, I'm going to shuffle some more papels. So yes, the IARC, sorry, which is the International Agency for Research on Cancer. So they have like these four groups, and two of which fall under a subcategory, to determine whether or substances, mixtures, or external exposures are in a carcinogenic category. So, for example, four would be the lowest, and they would say as probably not carcinogenic. Then they have like 2A and 2B. One is like probably carcinogenic. The other one is possibly carcinogenic. And then group one is, yes, definitely carcinogenic, right? So back already like in 2001, these phone masts by one of the professors who was the director of the IARC, which is part of the WHO, said, yes, we think that this falls definitely in, you know, category group B, which is possibly carcinogenic. And then there was 200 peer-reviewed papers to show actually this should be classified as a group one, definitely carcinogenic. So that now 20 years later, you have this new group go, oh, we need more studies.
But you've already got studies.
You've got, I mean, thousands of papers. And then you've got this emfscientist.org website. And it's worth mentioning that it's totally international. You've got scientists from all over the world.
All over the globe, yeah.
And the likes of you and I, unless we're in this field or a related field, can't sign this letter, you know, this. I don't know whether it's an appeal. They refer to it as an appeal rather than a petition. But you and I couldn't go and sign on this, you know, particular website.
No, these are, electromagnetic scientists, over 44 nations, and they've published 2,000 peer-reviewed papers. So,
yeah. The first paper from, that COSMOS cohort study can just go take a long walk off a short pier. That's all.
Right. Yeah. So, another article I believe you sent me from the Environmental Health Trust backs up, research shows that light from screens and the radiation from wireless can impact our sleep. Of course, the quality of our sleep profoundly impacts learning and memory. That's essential for retaining new information. You know, it goes on to say that research shows that sleep is a time when the brain cleans out its toxins accumulated during daytime. Ensuring healthy sleep is one of the most powerful steps we can take to prevent illness and protect our family's health and well-being.
Yeah.
So further evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also know, I mean, there's studies for this too, and there's an article, there are several articles that indicate that, our exposure to all of these lights, but particularly when we're looking at white light and blue light, so these bright white, often the neon lights were bad enough, the fluorescent lights were bad enough, but, white lights and blue light emitting thing, which we tend to get from our laptops and mobile phones, which is interesting because it took a really long time for manufacturers to include what they call sort of night mode setting, or making your screens on your laptops or on your phones more yellow, softer. So it took a really long time for them to admit that this actually disrupts sleep. Well, the reason is that it's a melatonin disruptor. Mm-hmm. Right. EMF also is a circadian and endocrine disruptor. It impacts, your ability then to produce melatonin, because what happens is melatonin is produced through your pineal gland or your third eye.
Mm-hmm.
Your pineal gland is responsible for your sleep-wake cycle. And even though it's not visible, it can determine light and dark. So when you have natural lighting, it's important because it sort of stimulates your serotonin, and then later on that gets transformed into melatonin when it's dark to let you know that it's time to sort of wind down for the evening, right?
Very important. Uh-huh.
And obviously we can talk sort of more broadly when we went into a world of electricity, the artificial light, that was a massive shift already for people because it charged people sort of to stay awake hours that they were normally not used to. In fact, you're dealing with sort of a much more natural thing of, it's dark and people sort of slowly wound down for the evening, right? Mm-hmm. But with the advent of electricity, and then really by the turn of the century, so many of the major cities already had electrical lines, and you had a lot of workplaces that included electricity. And this suddenly caused people to stay up a lot later.
Of course, yeah.
So fast forward to now, where we have issues of light pollution, because it's just excess of light, and mm-hmm. that is known to disrupt growth for plants. It disrupts our, our natural circadian rhythm. So it should be kind of understood that all of these things impact our sleep, right? Which is also why, on that same website, Environmental Health Trust, they have, some really great basic tips about making your bedroom or your living environment sort of less impacted by EMF, and particularly in sort of creating a sleep sanctuary, because you want to have sort of lower lights, softer lights. It's not just to get you in the mood, for sleep. Predominantly for that. But it's like you said, it's really important that when we go in into our bedrooms and unwind and we're preparing for sleep, that we don't have very bright lights. You do basic things like unplug your laptop, turn it off if you can, get it out of the room. Unfortunately, like they recommend things like, I say unfortunately, but that's because I'm, you know, my words, my brain is faster than my mouth. But what I wanted to say was if you are using your phone, like many people, like many of us do, you know, consider putting your phone in flight mode. So you don't get.
Good idea.
Have like a little Faraday cage pouch, and they're basically block all EMF and Wi-Fi access to it. So only when you take it out to look at it does it sort of work again. But the other thing to consider is if your bed is by a socket, especially like if you've got like multiple outlets on there, to unplug it if you don't need it.
Okay.
To unplug things if you don't need it, because those sounds are sort of vibrating in our brains.
Sure.
You know, and impacting sleep. Yeah.
All sorts of things buzz. I don't know. For some reason, just thinking of the Radiohead line, the band Radiohead there, it buzzes like a fridge.
Yeah. And that is that's really annoying. That's really annoying.
Yes, no, it's something I definitely have started to take a look into. But, you know, in my room here, I've got a humidifier for my instruments, especially during the dry cold months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got an alarm clock with blue light. I've got studio monitors. I've got an audio interface. I've got pedal boards and outboard gear. So my little studio here, so it's like I've got all sorts of things going on. Yeah. I've woken up, not proud to say, but I've woken up lying on my phone, my cell phone before, having fallen asleep. It falls down and you roll over on it. It's like, what's that?
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah. So sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. So I'm just definitely myself trying to be more mindful because these things aren't that harmful. You know, now I've taken a broader dive. So I know a little better.
They also just become a habit, a bad habit. I mean, it's really funny because there are all these like, you know, meditation apps to help you go to sleep, or you can watch a meditation, you know, or listen to a meditation on YouTube or some other outlet. And of course, you're going to be using your computer or your mobile phone for that. So there's a bit of an irony. Right. You're like, right. I'm going to listen to a meditation on YouTube.
Right. With these EMF signals also coming at me. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's
sorry,
also...
I was just going to say.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that. So what I try to be conscious of or conscientious of is that, okay, I'm listening to this, but, you know, what I will do is maybe put my brightness on like really, really low setting. I'll make my screen much more yellow. And then as soon as that meditation is over, and if I've sort of got into that state of sleep, or just before I'm really going to sleep, I just sort of unplug, turn off, and push away, you know?
Yes.
And that's sort of become my method, because I quite frankly, if I get out of bed, then I'll wake up. But if I can, I have my laptop on a little, you know, on a little table with casters on wheels. So what I can actually do is I unplug, turn off, push away. So that at least in that way, I don't have it on or close to my person.
Yes, exactly.
But before I so rudely interrupted you, Paul, I know you've got some other interesting references.
Oh, no worries.
You know, in regards to sleep.
Sure. So another name I'm sure a lot of you have heard, there's a couple of other names. So first I'll talk about someone who comes up quite a bit through different articles and podcasts is Matthew Walker.
Mm-hmm.
He's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. He is the director for the Center of Human Sleep Science at Berkeley, whose book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams, warns of a catastrophic, quote unquote, catastrophic sleep loss epidemic, which is causing a host of potentially fatal diseases. So I'll also note that he's originally from Liverpool, England, living in California here. He's been quoted as saying, once you drop below 7 hours, we can measure objective impairments in your brain and your body. The shorter you sleep, the shorter your life. Short sleep predicts all causes of mortality. So that's a bit sobering, that one there.
Yeah.
Yes, in an interview with The Guardian, Professor Walker said that sleep deprivation affected every aspect of our biology and was widespread in modern society. Mm-hmm. He says the problem is not being taken seriously by politicians and employers, with a desire to get a decent night's sleep often stigmatized as a sign of laziness, he says. Quote, it sinks down into every possible nook and cranny, yet no one is doing anything about it. Things have to change in the workplace, in our communities, our homes, and in our families. He says that no one wants to give up time with their family or entertainment, so they give up sleep instead. Anxiety plays a part. He says we're a lonelier, more depressed society. Alcohol and caffeine more widely available. These are all enemies of sleep. Going back, you know, he talks about the stigmatized sleep. We have stigmatized sleep with a label of laziness, Professor Walker has said. We want to seem busy. And one way to express that is proclaiming how little sleep we're getting, as if it mm-hmm. was a badge of honor, unquote. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this it's funny because that sort of badge of honor, it doesn't come out of nothing. It doesn't come out of the ether. You would see already various political figures and sort of leaders in industry, particularly, mm-hmm. sort of boasting about how little sleep they needed, right? And I think that's the other thing that you see. You know, you see people who would say, "Oh, I only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep," and then at some point in their lives, they might have other sort of very underlying health problems. Or diseases, whether it's, you know, dementia or whatever, but because we know that there's a correlation to some of these things with, you know, continuous lack of poor sleep. And so, especially in this sort of hyper-capitalistic thing, it's this idea of like, what was it? Was it Nike that had the slogan for a while? They were like, you can rest when you're dead. This kind of mentality, you know?
When I'm dead,
yeah. Yeah, you can rest when you're dead. You can sleep when you're dead. And I just thought, what a horrible, you know, who pitched that and thought that was a good idea?
Yeah, that's some interesting messaging there. It's like, well,
yeah,
you may get your wish sooner than expected.
Sooner than you expect. But when you see that kind of messaging and various forms of that messaging coming mm-hmm. through, you know, amongst politicians and a lot of sort of big names in big industries and businesses, it's easy to see then, like Professor Walker said, they're not interested in changing things.
Right. I think one of the podcasts I've seen him on, he talked about, they're only interested in production and consumption,
mm-hmm.
which I found interesting. So, yes. One of the last quotes here I have from Matthew Walker is talking about the priorities of, he said, quote, when did you ever see the NHS? An NHS poster urging people to sleep. When did the doctor prescribe sleep and not just sleeping pills? It needs to be prioritized, even incentivized. And one of the things he goes on to say, which in his book, I believe, is sleep loss costs the UK economy over £30 billion a year in lost revenue, or 2% of the GDP. He said he could double the NHS budget if only they would institute policies to mandate or powerfully encourage sleep. So that's a lot of money, and I imagine that would get some people's attention.
Yeah, and right. it's I mean, he's very much spot on, and I find it amazing that, you know, especially people who work in hospitals and in sort of medical professionals, whether they're nurses or doctors, they often have huge issues with not getting sleep, and these are people who we entrust with our lives very literally.
Sure.
So, it's sort of mind-boggling, really. And I think he's really spot on about all of his observations.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. The last thing I'll talk about is someone Oh, I know they've done shows together. I know Matthew Walker has been on Andrew Huberman's podcast, and Huberman, he's a PhD neuroscientist from Stanford University. I believe he studied at Cal Berkeley, I believe under Matthew Professor Walker. So he has a toolkit to deal with getting more sleep, and he even touches on some of the things that you were mentioning earlier. But he talks about early in the morning, close to sunrise, getting outside while the sun's at a lower solar angle, and getting some light into our eyes to sort of set our body for the day. He says it gives us more energy during the day. It's easier to fall asleep at night, depending on how bright or cloudy it is, anywhere from 5 to 20 plus minutes in the morning getting outside. He wants to reduce the amount of artificial lights in the evening before bed, as you mentioned. He says that sleep is a foundation for all mental health, physical health, and performance of all kinds. His tools are extremely in depth. He goes extremely in depth. He talks about the amount of light, the amount of dark you want in the day, body temperature, cooling down to an ideal temperature for sleep. Of course, he talks about diet, exercise, caffeine, supplements. He even talks about digital tools, meditation and relaxation. And he also credits Matthew Walker's book, Why We Sleep, The New Science of Sleep and Dreams, as bringing wider awareness to the issue. So I think these are two gentlemen to definitely look into, and they seem to know a lot, and they seem to know why it is such a big problem. So I definitely
Yeah.
encourage people to listen to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really good advice. My only question here for Huberman, and I think he's based out of Stanford, right?
Yes, he
Yeah.
is a professor at Stanford, and he studied at Cal Berkeley.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, when you're in a place like California, where you have a lot more sunshine hours and you have a lot more opportunity to be outdoors, some of that advice is easier to heed. Likewise, if you have a kind of schedule that is really grueling, and previously, or you were mentioning previously, people don't want to give up their social time and they don't want to give up family time. So they're willing to give up sleep. And if you don't have time in the morning to do that, and let's just say you're a family, you've got kids, you're trying to rush them off to school, you're trying to get off to
Sure.
work. So getting that sort of 10, 15 minutes outside in the sunshine is not always going to be practicable, right? It requires a big holistic change in your day to day. I think that's one thing to
That's
bear in mind.
a great point.
You have to really make some major changes in how you go to sleep, how you wake up in the morning, how you're going to carve time out for yourself if you've got family, to be able to talk to your partner, your spouse, whatever, and to your kids, and go between like 7:15 and 7:35, don't bother me, something like that. And how easy is that going to be with a 5-year-old? I don't know. The other thing is maybe making do in some other way. So, for example, if you are living in a climate where you are going to have major snow and it might be, minus 11 degrees Celsius, stepping outdoors might sound great, but like first thing in the morning, that is the last thing you want to do. But what you can do, and I know it's not the same, but if you can stand in front of a window and get some sunshine, and if the sun is out, or get some direct light in your face, it's better than nothing.
No, those are great points. Those are great points. I'm currently one of my favorite shows on YouTube is a lady, a couple who lives on Svalbard in the polar circle north, and they go through 2.5 months of polar nights. So
Yes.
I imagine they would have a real tough time, but they talk about that in their show. So
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the
that's
advice is
great
good.
points.
The advice is good and it's sound. I just think like one has to also bear in mind how practical is this for everyone? And I think this is the thing. You need to be able to take into consideration people's jobs, people's demographics, where they are, things like that. And then go, well, if you can't do that, here's the next best thing. Or if you want to engage in this, you're going to have a plan to sort of recalibrate what you've been doing up until now.
I think you probably would want to use the tools that will work best for your lifestyle. And also probably, I'm sure he's made a lot of people, sort of assess their priorities and, what may be important or what is possible
What is possible?
physically to do. So, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we're talking about, sleep and sleep deprivation, and it's interesting because there is so much consensus, around this. I remember reading a few years back about, articles that were done through the Sleep Foundation, through numerous other studies that were talking about the fact that students, particularly teens, from sort of middle school and the high school level, that would benefit from a later start date of their school day, right? That this would really improve both their academic performances in general, but also more importantly, their sleep, because once they start hitting puberty, they're dealing with hormonal changes, but also their sleep cycles shift. And so you have study after study after study that says it would be really ideal. There are more pros than there are cons in terms of the benefits that students would get if they started their school day later. And if you think that on average school begins at around 8 o'clock in the morning, give or take, and then in some cases doesn't finish until like what, four, half four, if you're including extracurricular activities, et cetera. And for some students, even later than that, then they're supposed to go home, do homework. Then of course they're going to be on social media. And so by the time they go to bed and then start, they're getting really very little sleep, right?
Sure. They need
So,
time for Minecraft as well, you
and Fortnite and whatever else, whatever
know?
else they're playing. But so, I mean, the thing is that, so there's a clear understanding that this is going to be important and there are loads of studies, but there's no implementation because they're like, oh, well, it's difficult for parents who work, to drop their kids off to school, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like these are excuses. I feel like there isn't a willingness to go, well, what if we try this? Right? I think there are, there have been some little programs here and there that have tried, and seen benefits, but it needs to be implemented at a much larger scale. And another thing, again, around sleep deprivation, and then we'll shift gears a bit. But it's really interesting that in 2019, there was a study done about sleep deprivation or poor sleep. And this was done by Philips, as in the light bulb company, the company Philips. And what I didn't know is that Philips, in addition to the household name, also produces, lots of equipment for the medical and healthcare industries. So they teamed up with a group called KJT, which again, I was like, who the heck are they? I have come down to say that they are a healthcare marketing group because they describe themselves as the following: a premier partner in healthcare commercialization, insight generation, evidence collection, and stakeholder communication. What does that mean to you, Paul?
That could mean a lot of things.
Exactly. Like there's so many companies where you just read and you go, so I still don't quite understand what you do. But I'm just going to come down to sort of their healthcare marketers. Probably everything from healthcare insurance to healthcare products. So anyway, so they did this study in 2019 and they did a study across 12 countries. And this included not just sort of Western countries, Western European countries were included, but you had also, countries in South America, Brazil, you had Japan, you had India. So this was quite a broad global study that they did. And it included over 11,000 participants. And then the outcome of the study was 62% of adults felt that they didn't get enough sleep, calsipres, right? The average, when they took the highs and lows, averaged less than 7 hours of sleep. So, and 44% of these participants said that their sleep had worsened over the past 5 years. So this was, again, this came out in 2019. So you're reading this, so you're reading this sort of, I read it's a short study, and you're like, good, good. And then they give you sort of this infographic. And that's when I go, why? Like, so the infographic comes out with all this information, and then they say their sort of conclusion is despite these high numbers, high and sort of disturbing numbers of people who are having poor sleep, 80% still refuse to go seek a medical professional for their sleep. So that's implying, automatically implying that everybody who has poor sleep needs to go and seek medical professional or needs to go to a clinic, because in fact, the study says like we need to push sort of clinical support system around this and a clinical study around this. So in other words, what Philips and this KJT ultimately want to do is boost the healthcare industries and by extension, the pharmaceutical industries as the way to solve this problem.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Rather than acknowledging, okay, yes, some people do have clinical issues when it comes to sleep. So they might have really big sleep apnea. They may have things like a deviated septum, which is, you know, preventing them from breathing properly. And they might, in that case, need to go and seek medical advice. Right. Fair enough. But I'm thinking if we know that so many of us, yours truly included, have to wean ourselves off of screen time as one of the biggest issues and find other ways of calming our mind down. We tend to, I think many of us, before we go to sleep, sift through everything that went in our day or what was bothering us. And we're trying to work things out and we're overthinking, and all those things don't require a device. They don't require a medical professional. I don't need a sleep hypnotherapist for this. I don't, I don't need pharmaceuticals for this. I just need to figure out a better way of managing it.
Yes. Yes. I can attest to that. I have had a lot of issues with, you know, just sort of all my sort of worries coming to a head right as I lay my head on the pillow to get ready for bed. And it's like, I finally figured out that I'd been pushing these things away throughout the day. And then when it was quiet and I was there with my thoughts, they came back with a vengeance. So I've sort of started trying to take a little bit of time each day and just think more about these things at that point. And then sort of like forgive yourself in the evening and just like, oh, that's not the time for this. But it's hard. But as you mentioned earlier, there can be, you know, anxiety that comes with it. But yeah, you're right. There are other things we can do ourselves.
Yeah, there are plenty of things, and we just need to get into that habit of doing it rather than going, oh, I need the easy fix, which it really isn't often an easy fix.
True. So, okay, we teased earlier about talking about sleep within a historical context. Do you have a little bit more on that?
We did indeed, and yes, I do. So I think this is really interesting because these kinds of findings give us a bit more pause for thought about how we're sleeping nowadays and how our ancestors may have slept. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think is worth considering is, you know, this idea of sort of this 8 hours straight sleep is not entirely true in our, you know, ancestry, in our ancestral history. Mm-hmm. So it's worth noting that obviously there are probably, depending on what you did what your job was, depending on the climate, depending on the season, that this very often dictated how you slept, you know, and how long you slept. Mm-hmm. But a particular professor, well, he uncovered or rediscovered this bit of long forgotten history. So the professor's name is Roger Eckrich. And back in the 90s, he was working, I think he was doing some research, working on a book, and was looking at people's activities at night from a historical perspective, and went to London to look into the archives. And I think at that point, there was like the Office of Archives in London held information from, say, like the early 1800s to, I think, up until that point. I mean, he went there in the 90s, but I think they held on to like a lot of this sort of historical information through to the early 2000s. But anyway, he goes in the 90s and is looking through various archives. And in one of these folders, he sees sort of much older vellum paper, which isn't really paper, vellum is vellum. But anyway, he sees a sort of a testimony that goes back to sort of late 17th century, so 1600s. And this has an account of a 9-year-old girl who's giving testimony about the murder of her mother, which is, you know, of course, this is quite a heavy duty thing to come across. But what got Eckrich's attention was the 9-year-old's information about what happened to the events prior to her mother's murder. And one of the things that she talks about is that she and her mother had woken up from their first sleep. Yeah. So, of course, his antennas go up. Because if you're saying that there's a first sleep, that would indicate that there might be
a second sleep.
Exactly. Right. So this was like, this was unheard of, you know, I mean, in our modern context, we had never really considered a second sleep. What? So, you know, this kind of opened up an entire new area for him. And he began to look more and more into this to see whether was this just sort of like a one-off for this, you know, for this child, or did this actually occur more broadly? And in fact, it did. So going back, you know, as far as the Middle Ages, the late Middle Ages, there are references to a first sleep and a second sleep in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. There are manuscripts which were written in like the 1300s, which refer to the premier somme, which means the first sleep. And there were like a whole list of like things to do between your first and your second sleep. Right. So this was everything from like, it's a good time to like, you know, I don't know, churn your butter to I'm making that one up. But there were things like, it's a good time to procreate between your first and second sleep, you know, good time for making babies. And, you know, this seems to have gone on for a considerable amount of time up until probably the first industrial revolution. We're looking at sort of the mid late 1700s. So there are, you know, he just found countless information about this. But what's interesting is that this wasn't just exclusive to Western Europe.
Okay.
So he found, you know, there were findings, first of all, that even predate the Middle Ages. And there were accounts even in ancient Egypt that would lead one to consider that, or lead one to believe that there were biphasic sleep patterns, at least evident as far back as, you know, 2000 BCE, and that, you know, Egyptians would often sleep for like 4 to 6 hours at night, and they would wake up for a period of sort of rest or leisure, and then would go back to sleep again for another 6 hours.
Yeah? Interesting. Yeah. When you told me about this, it definitely made me have less anxiety about any time that I do wake up. It's like, oh, yeah, historically, maybe this isn't so strange.
Historically. Yeah. And you find evidence of this, you know, in places like Oman. I think there were a couple of accounts. I have to double check, but I think like even in Japan, there were references of this.
Right.
So this biphasic sleep is, I think, for many of us, and then you were talking, like you were saying, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night. And this might be, there is now study to look at the thing, this might be a hangover, sort of an ancestral hangover of biphasic sleep.
Very interesting.
And that there are probably many, many more of us who actually would, if we could, you know, probably do well with not having an 8 straight hours, but maybe having a nighttime pattern where we slept. And if we could get up and, you know, like, be like, I'm going to help practice my guitar, you know.
Yes, that's what I've been doing.
Or with me, I'm going to now organize my drawers.
Yeah, so I think I'll be churning my butter, you know, now that I've got that idea in my head. So,
yeah, I mean, but I think the interesting thing is that, you know, you have probably things like the first industrial revolution and, you know, the changes in society that were going on, but probably a growing belief after that this sort of biphasic sleep was like, oh, people who were lazy and lack discipline.
Right.
Rather than thinking maybe there was actually probably a wisdom to it, because even though we want to rest at night and want to get those 8 hours, it may not always be sort of a natural rhythm for us.
Mm-hmm. This is true. That's very interesting. And of course, such a big historical marker like the Industrial Revolution is significant in the changing patterns, like sleep patterns. And
yeah, because you have suddenly like shift work, you know, yeah. And that kind of made it difficult, you know, particularly where some people had really ridiculously like 17-hour work shifts. Mm-hmm. So, many of them slept on factory floors. The conditions were really abhorrent. Mm-hmm. So, and then as we mentioned earlier, then you had like, you know, electricity, you know, that the light bulb moment. I would also deduce that this biphasic sleep might have been a development from our ancestors who were previously sort of more nomadic, tribal, hunter-gatherers, and it would have made sense, and even when they became agrarian and settled, but it would have made sense that you would have had people that would been up all night or take turns being up all night to either watch out for predators, to keep the fire going, to watch out for potential invaders. Mm. So that probably came out of like taking turns going to sleep.
Sure.
Then later on may have become part of sort of biphasic sleep.
Very interesting. Yeah. I can imagine that if everybody was asleep at the same time, that could have been deadly, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So. Quite literally, life mm-hmm. and death.
Sure, for them and for their animals. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. Wow. So yeah, this is definitely, and it's really really fascinating stuff. Like it's a rediscovery, you know, it's a rediscovery mm-hmm. of something. And for I think like for you, like for many people, go oh, so it's not just me.
right. So yeah, I'll relax a little more and
yeah,
not be stressed and anxious about this.
Yeah,
you know. Disturbance in sleep. So excellent.
Yeah. Unless, of course, you have to get up at 6 a.m. and then you're
oh, dear. Yeah.
All excellent. Right. Yeah. Well, now that you have heard a little bit about all of these different factors and different components involving our sleep or lack thereof, we'll give you a moment to ponder and digest all this while Paul and I, we're going to take a quick snooze. We'll just be back in 2 shakes. Hiya, we're back. Thanks for sticking around. So, sleep. Perchance to sleep well. It seems to have become a kind of holy grail. And obviously, when it comes to this topic, there is so much to sift through, isn't there, Paul?
Yes, indeed, there is.
Indeed. I think one thing that occurs to me is that while there's generally an established consensus that a lack of sleep or lack of good sleep is a major problem worldwide, there's far less cohesion or willingness within our socio-political and economic arenas to engender any long-term meaningful change. Unless, of course, said change involves pharmaceuticals, medical devices, your own personal investment in EMF-reducing equipment, sleep therapists, and so on. After all, if a light bulb and appliance company partner up with a healthcare marketing company for a study verifying what we already know to be true and only come up with a solution which directly implies that people struggling with sleep ought to be seeing medical professionals, buying medical equipment or pharmaceuticals, rather than addressing the real and potential underlying causes, well, that speaks volumes about where their priorities are, which is namely making more profit and off of our lack of well-being, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we do have to take responsibility and take into account our lifestyle, our health, what and how we eat, what may need to be changed and improved upon, but also other things which may or may not as easily be upended, for example, where we live or what we do for a living. Clearly, each of us needs to consider what is and isn't working for us, and like everything, it may require a bit of trial and error. I also sometimes wonder if our current socioeconomic matrix and other external factors weren't an issue, whether we might sleep differently. What if we just stopped insisting that all of us must fit into a tightly defined nighttime parameter of sleep? Obviously, this is all easier said than done. But there are tangible examples, albeit they few and far between, which show that these changes are not impossible. Consider that there are still places in the world where shops are closed on Sundays, and as it used to be, many shops would close for a couple of hours at lunch, particularly where a siesta was a logical rationale and a much-needed reprieve from scorching daytime heat. Why am I saying all this? Because these examples highlight that up until quite recently, the idea of rest was valued in many cultures. The advent of high tech and the internet has brought lots of interesting and wonderful opportunities. And I'm fully cognizant, I think like Paul, that we couldn't do this podcast without the technology.
This is true.
But it cannot be disregarded that this tech wave, especially for the past 20, 30 years, came with an expectation, namely, everything had to adopt a primarily American business model in order to survive economically. And so in doing so, places and people have lost some of their cultural traits and identities, as their views about work, life, and rest were often unfairly and I think myopically labeled as being lazy or inefficient. The always-on culture has contributed to a collective amnesia of our recent past, and in doing so, I feel that it has also contributed to our collective sleeplessness. Sleep is not just needed for our physical recharging and to reset. It's a way to connect to our inner lives, to dream, and to conjure up other possibilities, realms, and realities. It's a way to work through problems and issues we might not be able to do during the day. There is something to be said about slowing down, switching off, unplugging, going a bit more analog. We don't get enough of that. I suspect that many of us, if we not only lived better but felt better about ourselves and the world we live in, we might get much better night's sleep. There we have it. That's it for today. It was a rather big nutshell of information.
And we didn't even touch upon how the continued insistence of changing our clocks back and forth every 6 to 7 months can negatively affect our sleep.
Indeed. Neither Paul nor I claim to have any foolproof solutions, but clearly there are steps each of us can take to improve and gain better sleep and to be more aware of the contextual, historical, and external aspects which have influence over our thinking and our relationship to sleep.
And by us being more aware of some of these external factors, such as EMFs, there are opportunities for us to create collective momentum to either push back, mitigate, or limit our exposure to these. Whether it's making our living and workspace less of an EMF magnet, or simply talking to others and raising awareness.
Yeah, just slip in the topic of sleep into a conversation. It's pretty easy, right?
That's right. Yes, I'm going to take a little nap myself, I think.
Indeed. So on that note, thank you so much for tuning in. And hopefully some of you can now find ways of tuning out all of that noise and static and screen time and get a bit of shut eye. We hope you'll catch up with us on our next episode of QC. And in the meantime, keep those hamster wheels in your mind spinning. Be well and Godspeed.